Leadership is how we interface with the world around us. There are external forces driving us and pressures on us to achieve goals and objectives. What happens sometimes is that you get caught up in those pressures. They pull you off course. Or sometimes you get seduced by the rewards and incentives of being successful. If you don't have a clear sense of your true north, you may feel like you're drifting in the wind. What I just read out was part of the answer Bill George, a former CEO and also a senior fellow at Harvard Business School, gave to the question, why is True North important, in an interview he'd done. Our guest for this week, Chetan Maini, introduced me to this concept of True North. It wasn't a huge part of our conversation, but later, when I revisited this concept, it became apparent to me how it must have helped him. So, I thought, rather than preface what we talked about in the second part of our conversation, I'll introduce you folks to what it means to find your true north. I promise I'll keep that short. True north is essentially taking the time to allow yourself to find your purpose or your calling. You forge your true north through your values, your beliefs, and your purpose. There are a lot of questions you can ask to discover your true north. Here are a few I found interesting. What did you like to do when you were 10 years old? When was the last time you did that activity? List the 5 people you interact with most frequently, not necessarily friends alone. How is each helping you reach your goals or not? What is your biggest regret? If you could go back and have a redo, what would you change? Maybe some of those questions ring closer to home for our regular listeners. Well, that's because they're questions we ask at First Principles as well. So maybe True North isn't a concept you and I are all not too familiar with. Yet, I must say, in the context of this episode, it is. I'll give you a small hint as to why. Chetan took a break of almost 2 years before he started Sun Mobility. He was out building the electric future of India with Reva and Mahindra for close to 2 decades. This break was a period of reflection for him. And I must add, by no means was he confused as to what his purpose was. Very early in life, he knew what he wanted to do, as he made it clear in our conversation.
I think I was very clear, very young, at what I wanted to do, but I think that was just me.
Yet, one must reflect on the choices they're about to make, especially when you're taking a second shot at building something big. How did he go about it? Well, if you're intrigued, continue listening, and I'm sure you'll enjoy this conversation. Welcome to First Principles. I'm your host, Rohin Dharmakumar. Let's get started. In 2016, when you chose to step back from Mahindra Reva, you said, and I quote, "When you're the CEO and involved in one area, giving it 100%, you can't think about anything else." And then, of course, you had this overwhelming urge to think about what to do next and what you do best. You took almost a 2-year break in order to reflect and figure out what you want to do next. Could you take us through this reflection process? Because I think it's one of the least discussed times in an entrepreneur's life, this very important, it's almost like, you know, they've done something and they've left it, but they haven't figured out what to do next. From the outside, to a lot of people, it looks like they're whiling away their time. But in the mind of an entrepreneur during that time, there's a lot going on, right?
Right.
Because they're kind of defragmenting the learnings from what happened, trying to figure out dozens of potential possibilities of what can go wrong, and then trying to figure out where they want. So take us through those, like those 2 years, like when you exited, did you have a time frame in mind as to when, how long this process would take, and then what happened, and how did this process evolve?
So when I stepped down, Anand Mahindra asked me to help him with a few things. So 2-3 days a week, I was working with him on strategic areas and other global opportunities. So I had also helped start the Mahindra Racing team. And so it was a nice piece of the technology and was trying to see at a strategic level. So, you know, EVs was still very critical to me, but it was beyond that, right? What would happen on, you know, transportation and air? What would it go to other areas? So it's, there always has been interesting. How would I see driverless technology come in? A lot of stuff. So I sort of used that year in a combination of, you know, doing certain things for Anand. At the same time, you know, exploring areas for myself, right, on what it was. I was part of also the Young Global Leaders in the World Economic Forum. So I had a 2-week program at Harvard, and I was very fortunate to go for that for 2 weeks, or, you know. And one of the books and the professors was Finding Your True North, right? And, you know, it was really a very reflective time of trying to figure out your true north, what's driving you, what are you good at. So I think that was another very helpful thing. And, you know, when you're busy thinking about it, you don't have clear space. And sometimes you just need that little bit of space to start to think, and the ideas automatically come in. So your morning walks were becoming a host of ideas and things. I also worked to see, understand challenges. So I helped during that time, worked with the government of India on certain policy matters and said, what are the challenges the government is facing? And I tried to bridge it to say, these are the technology levers you could use and help that. In the process, I worked with BMTC. They want to go electric. They say, can you help us? I didn't have Sun Mobility. This is before Sun Mobility. And I realized that I worked for 2 months figuring out the solution for Bangalore of how to do 6,700 bus electric. And I came up with slow charging, fast charging. The numbers weren't working out. Then I said, well, maybe if I swap the batteries, would it work? And said, yeah, the numbers work. So I went back and I gave a proposal that you have, you know, 35 depots if you put them with electric, except for 2% of your fleet that did electronic city to airport, you could do everything in Bangalore electric and you'd be cheaper off, right? Same time, you know, in Delhi, I saw these rickshaws and I go, what the hell are these rickshaws? And I said, I want to take a ride in them. These are the electric rickshaws, right? I hadn't seen too many of them. You don't see them in Bangalore. And talking to the driver, he said, battery, you know, gets dead in 9 months and stuff. And I said, hey, this could be great if you swapped. So the concept of swapping started to come as a result of experiencing things. Now, I always felt...
But it was an unguided experience in the sense that you didn't know, you were not explicitly looking to validate a market.
No, it started to come in between these two. And I said, hey, this seems a lot. And then it started reflecting on what has passed, right? And at one point in Rewa, I actually separated the batteries from the vehicle and leased it. And I knew my sales went up by 30-40%. Right, so I knew that this issue of bringing and creating a new model, but that was just sort of financially separating it, but not creating a service around it. Right, there was a company called Better Place that raised a lot of capital.
No, that's and, right. Like Shai Agassi's ex-SAPC. That's right.
And there's a gentleman who wrote a book on that, and so I, you know, spent time with talking to him and saying, "What are your learnings?" Right. Then I started getting in deeper. So I went to Taiwan where there was a company, you know, a couple of companies doing it. I went to China, I went to Europe, saw these solutions, understood what worked, what didn't work. And over 40 battery companies I visited globally. What are your tech? Because I need this requirement. Can you develop this chemistry? Because it needs to be very long life, very different requirements than what was available. So we have a very unique chemistry that we use on this front. It allows us to differentiate ourselves. And then started to sort of, you know...
By that you mean that not all lithium-ion batteries are created
correct,
the same.
Right, exactly. So our batteries last 3 times longer than a typical, you know, scooter battery, for example, right? And within that I said, okay, now what do you need to solve? And that's when, you know, these, and then I met Uday, who's my partner. I knew him from years before, but we kind of, he was down here. We just got together and he says, hey, we're talking to this company in Japan and they've been talking of this thing called battery swapping. And I said, before I do anything, I want to talk to you since you've been in this. And I laughed and I said, you know, last 6 months I've been working on a solution around this. And he says, oh, we should do this together. So then we ended up spending time and you know, slowly things started to come together. But the space in between, I think, was very helpful. It was there was no pressure on me to say I need to do this tomorrow. Also, I didn't stop completely. I think doing some consultancy, which was also tech-oriented, allowed me to keep in something that I was doing, but did not have this sort of responsibility
of day-to-day execution.
I could be flexible, which gave me some space, right? And you know, I think at that point, it all started to happen. And there would be, you know, my wife would be surprised sometimes at 2 in the morning. She'd say, I'm not there. I'm probably in the other room on a chart.
Because the
writing.
Dots just connected.
Dots just connected. I woke up. I'm doing all my stuff there. And, you know, and so the first patent, like I said, I filed even before I started the company, right? So it got me back to what I was core at, was the tech and the business and all the pieces of the puzzle. That year helped me look at it. So I had a full business model, you know, how the tech would work, everything before I hired anyone in the company. I mean, the blueprint was there, right? It also helped, therefore, because the broad blueprint is there. What you do within that, you can change. But the broad blueprint and vision was very clear, which sort of enabled people to understand what they had to deliver. And that allowed us to go to market much quicker. And the key thing is you struggle a lot in the early stages, right, when you're in the sandbox. And it was important to define that clearly.
How did you come across your first 10 colleagues or employees?
So the first two was my assistant who worked with me earlier, and she had gone somewhere else. And the moment I said, I'm starting, she said, I want to join you. Another colleague who had worked with me earlier at Strategy had left for a startup, and I really enjoyed working with him. He was young, and he came in. So they were my first two before I even started the company. I hired them, and I said the first day they joined with me. A lot of people I had worked before with, who I really enjoyed working with. So in the early stages, I got a few of them, which is good, right? Through.
How would you describe, like, if I were to ask you, hey, Chetan, when you think back about the people that you worked with over the last 10, 20 years, and if you had to assemble a team, what kind of people, what kind of traits stand out in your mind that would make you go back to a certain subset of those people and say, hey, would you want to work with me? What are you looking for?
So it depends on the space you're in. But clearly, people who say, I'll do this and it gets done and you don't have to think about it, were clearly that first list. Right.
Sure. People agency and responsibility.
Right. Absolutely. And right. People who you moved roles and took the new role on very well. Right.
So that's, you talked about learning.
Correct.
And the ability
to switch.
So
you had that part of it was very important. Right. And others who are very soft-spoken, humble, but very deep tech. Right. And they may not have always come, but you knew that on the tech side, they would deliver, right? And they had to be looked at sort of, you know, looked at differently. In the early stage, you're a tech company, right? Even today, we have 175 people in engineering and R&D. So out of 500, that's a pretty large size for a company like us, right? And so it was sort of looking for that. But then there also had to be fresh blood, right? You know, someone had come and wanted me to fund a startup. It wasn't going too well. I said, come join me, right? But I'll fund you on the side. And I gave him a bit of money and I said, come and work with me for some time. And then eventually he joined me. So there were a lot of these people who, and then they brought in a lot of other youngsters. So at the early stages, there was a lot of younger group people, you know, and I loved the diversity that I wanted to bring in there. So I started to look at that.
Why is diversity important for you while building an organization?
You know, it's sort of this. You need, everyone gets too, when you're in an organization for too long or in a certain way, your thinking style becomes
group
one.
Think,
it's group thinking, of. Right? And you need someone to challenge you. And so that diversity brings about that sort of construct because people look at the same problem in different ways. And I think that's where, to me, diversity from where you worked before to your upbringing, to your gender, your experiences, all of that add to a set of diversity, age, right? And that to me really starts to look at things quite differently. And the more you can do that, I think, and if people have mutual respect for that part of it, that they can appreciate each other's ideas, then I think you can really build something world class.
Got it. Let me flip that question. What kind of people would not succeed at Sun Mobility and would probably leave it?
You need to work a bit in chaos. If you need everything perfect, that wouldn't be us, right? You need to be entrepreneurial, right? If it's a problem and you complain that's a problem, that won't work. You need to be part of the solution and fix it, right? You should be comfortable with change, right? And from the industry, from your role, from everything, you can't be, you know, so, you know, really, really committed beyond your 9 to 5, right? So if you're looking for that 9 to 5 straight, that's not Sun Mobility for you.
What's different about starting a business in your 40s versus your 20s? You've done both.
I think your aggressiveness is much higher when you're younger. You're a little bit more calmer when you're probably older. I would say that's one. So I was.
How does that affect the way you look at a business or think about a business? How did a calmer Chetan think differently about Sun Mobility?
I would say I'm a little more reflective, right? And I was a little more impulsive, right, on that front. Not to say I still had a fairly good way of decision making. That was you know, logically looking at it, but you are you think a little through more of, okay, if this happens, then this could happen, and this, and you go through the construct a bit more, right, and think of a plan B, sort of in real time, right? It's not about spending this, but it becomes a natural way of your thinking. Versus at that point, you've never done something, right? I thought I'll build an electric car in a couple of years and finish. I mean, I thought, how hard can it be? But you have a sort of the ignorance of what you're doing in the beginning.
The energy, ambition, and ignorance of exactly, youth, right? I mean, you raced a solar car across Australia, so yeah. Why would it take more than 2 years to build an electric car?
So it's all it was you know, part of that part of, I think. You know, I would say at this point, I was a lot more, early stages here also I was hands-on, but I was a lot more hands-on in Reva. And here I wanted to sort of build the foundation, but sort of take a step back after that and have the team sort of do a lot more, right? So that was also a change of my leadership style from where I was earlier to where I am today, right? Still working on it, but it was a change for me on that front.
And what kind of work hours do you follow?
I mean, typically I start work at around 9:30 and probably finish by 7. But there's generally some calls post that, you know, post dinner or something there. And Saturdays is probably half a day, but not at work. I'm doing my thinking a lot on Saturdays and how I want to, you know, spend half a day just by myself or with some people.
I was going to ask you that question because earlier you talked about that time period when you don't have, I mean, the when you were between companies, and that, like you said, like connected the dots and became one of your most fertile periods in terms of thinking and innovation. So one of the questions that I want to ask you at that time, I didn't, and now I realize that, is can you do those more consciously but on a more frequent basis? Of course, not everybody can leave their job and take a year off to connect the dots. But you certainly can, from what you're saying, like on Saturdays, take half a day off to kind of consciously give yourself the time to say, I'm not devoting this to a particular meeting. What do those Saturdays look like for you?
So I sometimes work with mentors or others, thinking of areas which are new and could be organization, could be another challenge. I spend some time on that. I look at sort of some of the key sort of challenges that I've gone through and start to reflect around how I think I could solve them. I start to look at where will the company be in the future? How would we look at these? I park them in a different bucket because if I go and talk to the team and everything while they're doing all of this, it's going to drive them nuts. So I have to learn to park those to say when are the right times. But always thinking about, you know, that piece where someone else isn't, because everyone's busy in doing here and now. Who's thinking about the future, right? So I need to spend a bit of time, you know, thinking about that and then trying to see how that aligns and what's the right time that comes through. So it's probably broadly in, and it could sometimes be, you know, if some problem has happened at work, technical problem, I may spend 4 or 5 hours and, you know, I get into where I shouldn't, but I get into trying to solve it and then it's all scribbles on my, you know, pad. And then I've emailed that to the team. I said, hey, do you think this will work?
That's actually my next question, which is, are there times when your team comes to you and says, wait, hold on, you're thinking too far ahead. We are solving like something right now and you're thinking about something that needs to be done 6 months down the line, 12 months down the line, 18 months down the line. And you're like thinking, no, they're all connected. Does that happen?
A lot. And I'm glad it does. And I'm glad it has for two reasons. One, I'm glad that people speak up now. I think in my earlier days, when you're a very strong founder and you've come and everyone's built up, it's harder for people to voice their opinions in a way here. But I respect those people who do that. And I think that I hear it a lot. And I say, okay, you're right. Let's pause this. Let's have a conversation a month from today for an hour on this when you guys are ready, right? But let's not do anything. Or month and a half from today. So I make sure it's part of it, that they're thinking of it. But I recognize that when I want them to come to that meeting, they shouldn't be thinking of the other stuff. And we should be thinking of it in a different mindset. It's easy for me to switch off and on. It may not be the same for others.
Absolutely. So one of your jobs as a founder is to every now and then push your colleagues beyond what they're doing right now in the short to medium term and think about things that they don't really need to. Like, I mean, they don't need to look 24 months into the future because they're trying to solve something which is 90 days from now or like, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you said earlier that one of the great things that you've done is you've now have like a professional CEO who looks at the, so therefore your context switching is reduced. Has it helped you kind of your mind for more forward looking thinking and not keep thinking back about what's happened to execution? Why is this deadline delayed, etc.? Because that context switching is actually something which is very hard.
Yeah. It generally has significantly reduced. But a lot of us is a tech company. So I do try and spend that extra time around the tech because that's the strength of mine. And I think when I'm interacting with the tech team, we're able to work together, brainstorming and getting in. And sometimes I am another part of the team helping that. And it's nothing about being what level you are, but it's about solving a problem. So in those ways, I'm quite involved sometimes, but I think it's the right thing for me because you are a tech business and technology has to be seamless. But looking at each piece of the HR or the management or the sales and things like that, I'm probably far less involved, right? The CEO looks into all of that. But we have good review mechanisms that we brainstorm, understand the big picture, but I don't need to be involved in day-to-day. But more on the strategic side, on the fundraising, on the partnerships, India and globally, and on the tech are probably things that I spend more time on, which is very good, helpful for me.
I normally ask my guests about mental models and first principles. Now, you built an electric car in India in 2001. So it goes without saying that you have to have applied first principles thinking to a lot of the problems that you solved. In fact, you talked about it, many of the functions, product, marketing, engineering, etc. You had to think from first principles because there were no equivalents in India. How has your thinking around mental models evolved? And do you have any favorite mental models that you find yourself applying to your decision-making when it comes to really significant and major decisions?
Yeah, I find this, very often teams come and talk to me and say, we can either give you low cost or we can give you sort of, you know, high quality. Like it's always an or. And I think true innovation happens when you change that to an and. So for me, it's always been, can you ask the question differently, right? And I'm taking you back to just an example, you know, 20, 25 years ago at Reva, customers wanted that they had accidents under 10 kilometers per hour and their body got damaged, right? An electric vehicle, you need something very lightweight. You were low-cost product, so you needed tooling investments to be very low. You were sustainable, so you didn't want to sort of, you want to use materials that were sustainable. And every time you bring this equation together, it's either you can get it sustainable or this. Eventually, the technology we used for the body allowed it to be dent-proof, allowed it to be cheaper, was pre-impregnated with color, so there was no painting, no paint plants, right? And it was really looked completely differently, and no one had such things when we launched it at that time. The question was asking and not or, right? And I think that's been very helpful, especially in technology areas, right? The other, even till today, and, you know, I remember my mentor in 91 when I worked my first summer intern, one of my summer internships, you know, took me through this decision matrix, right, of creating. And I like the fact that you can use data, but then you also use your gut at the end, because your gut strengthens over a period of time as you have more experiences. But your gut or your other part gives you biases too, right? So when I sometimes find that my biases are strong, right, I like to take a step back and use, you know, objectively a decision matrix. Here's the pros, a number's on it. What does it do? I literally get on Excel, I put it in, and do that. And I do that very often, even today, right? And I find, therefore, I can, when I have biases, it helps me judge if my biases came. And then I'd ask someone, what do you think this should be? No, I think your priority is right. And the numbers change. I said, oh, that means the decision would be this. Yeah, so it allows you in a framework to sort of discuss things. So, you know, many other things, but these are a couple of examples probably.
Good. You did reveal your age accidentally by saying something which kind of I relate to very much, which is whenever I think of a problem, I open up Excel and put into that, right? That comes from an earlier era. My colleagues had to tell me this when I said that, like, anything you give me, the first thing that I do is open up Excel and put some numbers into it, and that's how I start thinking. And the younger generation doesn't think Excel first, right? Maybe it's Google Sheets first. Maybe it's something else
first. Yes, you're probably right. It's so, whatever you've used as when you're growing up, yeah.
But in terms of brainstorming and thinking, are you a notes person? Are you a whiteboard person? Are you an Excel person? Are you someone who needs to express it somewhere in order to see what's happening?
So there's two parts. If I'm doing it myself, I clearly would, you know, use my pad and take digital notes or physical. Draw out stuff, look at pros and cons, write through it. I'm very much kind of putting it in paper and understanding it. That could be in a disorganized or organized fashion, depending how you look at it, and that's very key. Also, when I do brainstorming with the teams, I feel that that helps a lot, is just having, you know, things on paper. And I'd go up to the whiteboard and I'd write it down if you're doing it, and encourage the team to also do it. So yes, I'm a lot more of expressing it visually. It helps to put the thoughts clearly. It helps others to visualize what you're thinking and helps to arrive at a decision based on all of this. And I just find that more useful and more clarity of thought.
How did you find the transition that the pandemic enforced of going from purely work from office to purely remote to now some version of hybrid? And what has that transition been for you? I mean, what is Sun Mobility like? Is it Is it 5 days a week from... And what's your views largely? I mean, the question that I'm trying to ask is, what are your views on working and productivity and collaboration in terms of either work from office or work from home?
Sure. So at Sun Mobility, if you're manufacturing, it's 6 days a week. If you're field support, you're 7 days a week. But if you're engineering, sales and everything, generally 5 days a week, right? So that would be the standard way of looking at it. You know, I feel that in most cases, right, this collaborative, the soft parts of collaboration being together just can't be beaten, right? It's certain things that are, you walk across, you speak, you have a coffee, you discuss it, you whiteboard it, you just call another colleague, hey, can I get your input? That process is so much more seamless. And I find that the effectiveness is extremely high. But I think certain roles, if they were clearly defined and have very little interdependency, so if there's a coder who knows exactly what to do, maybe they need to be left alone, right? And they're probably far better off to do it, but they come back. But often, even for them, if the interactions aren't done correctly, it's very inefficient, right? So I think it needs to be based on your role, the company, where it is, right? Finally, a job has to be done. Right? Honestly, if you'll agree to it and that can be done way A or way B, I don't care, right? But in something like this where technology and field and business all need to come together, it's harder doing it. But we've learned how to do virtual more. So if someone's taking a day off and working a day off a week on remotely, I think that works okay. It gives them a bit of a break, but it also gives a sort of balance. And I find that this sort of a hybrid model with little flexibility, as long as it doesn't impact work, is fine.
And here's an interesting question. Do you like driving cars?
Yes, I enjoy driving cars.
What car do you enjoy driving right now?
I have a... around the colony or whatever, I have a Reva convertible. Which is just one of a kind. So I use that sometimes. And generally, I'm driving an Ioniq 5 electric. So yeah, I would say probably since the last 25 years, maybe 99% of my journeys have been electric.
Is that like some way, in some ways, tied to your identity that, like, you know, you gotta drive electric? Have you driven a petrol or diesel car in recent times?
I do, and you know, it's horrible. Okay. I was in Europe and you know, I asked for electric and they didn't have it, and I was just cursing it, and you know, and I'm like, my God, I can't believe, you know, how sucky this is, right? Once you get used to electrics and all the features in it and everything, and you've just driven that, and the quietness that you have, right? And last year in Goa, and, you know, I said, okay, normally used to, in those days, rent a Bullet when I was younger, and this time I said, okay, they didn't have those, I'll rent a scooter, and I went on, and I go, oh my gosh, this doesn't pick up or anything after you, you know, I drive electric scooters.
Oh, like, you're this thinking is, the linear curve of acceleration.
This
and
is
all.
Just not there, right? You know, so you're just, there's a disconnect between completely. I mean, that instant acceleration is something I've just been used to for a very long time, and you just don't get it on ICE vehicle.
Tell us about, you're married.
Yes,
you have children?
I do.
How old are they?
Older is 19.
You have two kids?
Yes, my son's 19, my daughter is 16.
Oh, wow. So your son's, what, in second year of college?
First
year of college.
Yeah.
And how was Chetan as a parent?
I think it was different at different stages, correct? Probably when they were very young, I unfortunately didn't have as much time with them. My wife Kim was much more part of the entire, you know, upbringing process. But as they got older, you know, I've also made that time with them. And, you know, at this point they are, it's a great relationship. We enjoy, you know.
What do you bond over?
we bond over movies. We play games every day. It's game night almost every night after dinner, right? Dinner time and meal time is without phones, just, you know, spend time with each other. You know, we go on walks. Daughter's now wanting to scuba dive, so I'm going to take her diving to get her certified now. So, you know, and so we go cycling. We do a lot of things together. So, you know, it's... and I think the conversations are changing now as they're maturing, and it's really nice in terms of where they are at this stage.
What advice do you have for them from your own? I think, like, you know, you got in as an entrepreneur fairly early,
right?
Where are they on that curve? I mean, I'm sure there's no pressure. My question doesn't in any way imply that there is that pressure, but. What do you see the differences between them today versus you when you were around their age?
I think I was very clear, very young, at what I wanted to do, you know, but I think that was just me. But I can't expect that from them. So for me, for them, it's just what interests you. Encourage them to take different classes.
I think you're an outlier. I mean, honestly, there are a few people who kind of stumble into what they want to do while they're at college and continue doing that for
like
25,
30
years.
And so I never put that on them. I said, you got to just find what you... I just said, I was fortunate to find what I was passionate about very young. I said, I have friends who found that much later. So there should be no pressure that before going to college, you need to know, and the first year you need to know. You have time. You know, try out what it is. But the moment you know what you like, then things will line up. So experiment. And understand it, and giving them a sense of openness to look at it. And I think they appreciate that, and, you know, and wherever they are, we're there to support them, whatever they want to do, right? No push to saying go this way or that way, right, at all.
Do you read books? Do you find the time to read books?
Not as much.
Do you have the attention span to read books? Because that's one of the other things that I think many... Correct. Founders and entrepreneurs suffer from.
So I enjoy reading more on tech stuff or newsletters or, you know, just bits of information and news that sort of stimulates me on that stuff. And I think today there's a lot in social and everything else. I do read the Ken on weekends. So
thank you.
But I think the part that I have been reading a lot more is on spirituality. So I do read every day.
What kind?
So, you know, I do read the Gita. I read other books on spirituality. So I do some at least half an hour every day. I do read on that. So that's become last maybe 4 years or so. I've been doing.
Do you meditate?
More. Yes, I do.
Guided, unguided. Any tips? Because that's another thing that many professionals and founders struggle with. Focusing and meditation.
I do both. Sometimes I would do guided. If I'm a bit more disturbed and needs a little bit more, I find the guided works. If I'm finding that I'm already pretty good, then I can go unguided and just do it myself. But sometimes, once in a while, I do guided side. So I do both.
Do you have any tips on how to get better at meditation for those of us who've tried it many times but, like, you know, fail?
For me, this is a morning time. Works really well. I like that first hour of undisturbed thing. And I think some alom alom, you know, alternate breathing helps set it up, gets you sort of aligned. And sometimes some light chanting music in the background. It's helped me. And in between, sometimes during work, just taking a pause for 5 minutes and just closing your eyes and trying to chant something to clear it up has also helped a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for those tips. My last question to you. On a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you with your life? You can only pick a number.
I know. I would say 8.
All right. I won't question you any further. Correct. But thank you so much, Chetan, for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.